Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. All right. We are back. I have Kellen still here with me. Thank you for not leaving me again, Kellen. I have abandonment issues now. Thanks to you. Just kidding. We're going to jump right in to the next topics. Let's talk, Kellen, a bit about politics and conflict. This could be broken into 3 different categories: U.S. politics, global politics, and then conflict. We're just going to kind of mash it all together. I just have to start this by saying it's so hard. I think this is the hardest year that we've had so far of being able to cram in everything that happened in 2025. There's always lots of stuff that happens, but it just feels like I can't even begin. Like, going into politics, if we wanted to really talk about what happened in politics in the U.S. and across the globe, like, it would be 2027 by the time we finish talking about it.
Yeah, and it makes me think of what we mentioned earlier, which is that we become numb to it. Like, so much has happened and so much of it has been crazy. And call it flooding the zone or call it whatever you want, but I see some insane political thing that pops up in my newsfeed, and like, I might even read the headline. I probably will just scroll past it because it's just, there's so much of it.
So much. Well, and you said yesterday when we first started the episode that, you know, when we were recording before, you were always feeling like something big was on the horizon, something big was going to happen, and yet Collapse is this more gradual thing. And then I look back on an entire year and I'm like, well, before this year, would we have thought everything that could happen with Trump would happen? I mean, we did, because we made a Patreon thing where we came from the future and talked about what he did. And it was a lot of this type of stuff. But the truth is that, like, man, reality is so much stranger than fiction. We never could have guessed on that podcast where the last broadcast. We came from 2032. We talked about Trump won, right? We recorded this before Trump had won, but we were like, yeah, Trump won, and he did all the censorship stuff and all this other crazy stuff, and he had a third term and all this. And yet, looking back on just his first 10 months, we're pretty much at a year now, his first year, and like, I could never have guessed the sheer craziness, the number of things that he did, the intensity of the things that he did, the absolute, like, insanity, and I mean that in the literal term, of things that came from President Trump and his administration this year.
So how did you decide what you're going to have for 2025?
I think we'll just talk about some of the biggest things, right? So number one, we elected Trump. And by we, I don't mean me, this country that we inhabit.
We the people.
Yeah. Elected Donald Trump. That in and of itself is like a condemnation of humanity here in this locality. It's messed up.
Unless, and by the way, I didn't vote that way either, unless you trusted in the promises he was making.
Yeah, but even many of the promises that he was making were evil. Like, people knew what he was going to do. Like, he staged a coup in his first term.
Oh, I do know.
His promises were that he was going to remove 20 million immigrants from the country. And
No, but it's all framed in, like, you're going to be safer. You're going to be more economically prosperous. You're going to have more rights.
Going to take out the deep state.
Yeah. Like, and we've talked about this before. We've both talked about how disgusted we are by everything that's going on, while also recognizing, like, we know a lot of good people who voted that way.
Yeah.
And it's just
who got duped.
Well, yeah. I don't know how, how people didn't see all of this coming.
Yeah.
That we've been experiencing.
Totally. And this is a nice reminder for me that once you left the podcast, you were a grounding influence for me.
You went full on.
You kept me more politically neutral, and I'm not. Having you here today is great because it's a reminder that I need to rein it in a little bit. All right. Trump was elected president, and it's been really great since. Everything's been so fun. What are some of the things that happened this year? We had the longest government shutdown in history. I saw a stat somewhere that shows now that Trump, you know, of all 47 presidents that we've had, I guess 47 non-consecutive because Trump is 45 and 47. Anyway, he holds now the vast majority of time in government shutdowns. Does that make sense? So you've got this guy who's quoted before he ever became president saying that government shutdowns are the president's fault and it's a sign of a bad president. And now he alone, one single president, has more than 50% of all of the number of days spent in shutdown.
You know, he did promise less government.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to look at that. ICE. Yeah, it's been a massive issue. And I think it's another one of those things that just like you see it on the news. We've seen it on the news now for months and months and months. And so now you hear like, oh, there was an immigration raid in an apartment complex, or a child, you know, got ripped away from her mother and the mother doesn't know where the child is or whatever. There's like so many of these terrible stories that have happened, and yet they make the news less and less. There's less outrage each time. It's becoming more normalized, and that's terrible.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting about this, I think about, for example, parts of Africa where there is so much disease and so much malnutrition. People are starving. And like everybody knows that, right? Like you could ask anybody in the US and they would know that there are regions in Africa where people are starving. But it doesn't really have any sort of an emotional impact for most people. And yet people I know who have gone and lived there, like it haunts them perpetually, and they try to do everything they can to change that situation. And I think about it in a similar way here. People know that there are all these deportation and there's like extreme brutality in a lot of these instances with ICE. But when you just hear about it in general, that there are people that just think like, oh, well, good, they weren't here legally, or they didn't, you know, there's criminals amongst them or whatever. But then when you actually see some of like the video footage of some of these really intense examples of people being stopped, humiliated, like sometimes brutally or violently, like it's when you start to see that I think it really has the emotional impact it should.
And yeah, there's a part of me that's like, our brains aren't meant to store all that, to really be able to see everything that's happening all the time. And yet, at the same time, we should try, I think, in some ways, because it keeps us feeling and understanding and not getting desensitized. We shouldn't get desensitized to it. We should be really pissed off about it, right? So going along with that, we've got the National Guard and the military sort of being used, being sent into multiple different locations, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Portland, Chicago, and others, where you know, it's been deemed by judges to be illegal. And that leads into this whole other thing where we've got all these legal questions now about what happens if Trump and the administration doesn't listen to judges' orders, to the Supreme Court even. And we're in a moment where we're really trying to figure out, where does the Supreme Court stand? Will they bend over and bow to Trump and take whatever it is he asks for, or give whatever he asks for? Will they draw a line? And if they do, will he obey it? It's this sort of struggle to see, A, will Trump disobey the law and really just embrace full authoritarianism? And B, will he have to, or can he continue to use the Supreme Court because they'll do what he wants, with Congress doing what he wants because Republicans hold the House and Senate and all this stuff? And that's one thing to really watch as we go into 2026, and we'll talk about this when we talk about the next year, but is what's going to happen in those midterms. And I think that will be a big deciding factor in the type of power that Trump has and in the way that he seizes it.
And I used to always think that our government was set up in almost this perfect way to have the right checks and balances. But I think I've learned recently there's a major gap there, because there's so many examples of a judge saying like, no, Trump can't do that. And then he just goes and does it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, who's going to enforce that ruling, that judgment? Unless like somebody actually rises up against him, unless there's a coup or whatever, like how would anybody just stop him from doing some of those things?
Right. I mean, do you remember whenever we did the last broadcast and we were talking about what was going to happen in the future and trying to game plan, we were talking about Project 2025. And I remember off mic, you and I kind of had this conversation about it, and you were like, how, this stuff can't happen. It's illegal. He can't just do it because he says he's going to do it. Like, like the whole law serves to stop this, you know? And it was like, I remember thinking like, yeah, Kellen's right. The law is there for this. But then it was like this question of what happens if he just doesn't listen? Is someone going to arrest him? And the Supreme Court made very sure at the end of last year when Joe Biden was still president, this was still a conservative Supreme Court. They ruled that as long as the president was doing a official act, that he was immune. That right there basically just put a whole stop to that question. If they, all they have to do is rule that what he did was an official act and he's immune from the law. That's terrifying. That's what we're facing now.
Yeah. And along the lines of those kind of loopholes where you can just declare an official act and then all of a sudden he can do it. Same thing goes with declaring something as a state of emergency, right? Where he's done that so many times to be able to deploy troops or whatever it is he wants to do.
Or declare that something is a weapon of mass destruction, which he just did with fentanyl. Or declare that a certain group is a terrorist organization, which he just did with Antifa. He basically just says, I get to declare it, and we already have the infrastructure to be able to take action based on that declaration. If we have a terrorist group, we have certain freedoms, you know, to act as a military against them. If we have weapons of mass destruction, we can go invade that country. And in that way, like, he just kind of slimy and sneaky, but I mean, it's not even sneaky. We all see it, but there's nothing that people can do to stop it. And that's where things, I think, were a little interesting this year. I think I expected to see more in terms of protest and disruption. We had the No Kings protest, which was great to see people out. But in terms of like the vast amount of action that would be needed, I don't think that met. You know, if you think of the type of protests or riots that you see in France or other countries, people don't put up with that crap. And here, I don't know if it's a cultural thing or if it's that, you know, some people say we just still have it too good. You're not going to get people who have a lot to lose because they are making money at their jobs and they're able to buy groceries right now and do all these things. They're not going to put that in jeopardy to go out and protest and riot.
We're not desperate enough yet.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, like you see something happening to somebody else and you're like, oh, well, yeah, that sucks for them. But like, I got a job to go to and I've got kids to feed and I've got responsibilities and I can't get myself jailed, you know, because that would screw everything up. And it would for so many people. And so, yeah. And then the last piece of maybe why we didn't see as much demonstrating this year is that that's what Trump wants. He desperately wants to be able to invoke the Insurrection Act or declare martial law or whatever. He feeds on the riots and the violence to be able to say, this is the left. This is what Antifa does. Can't you see, you know, the violence that's being enacted here and video of people fighting cops or shooting off fireworks or whatever it is would just feed perfectly into the propaganda to say, this is why we need the military on the street. This is why National Guard has to be there, and especially in these blue cities. And I think that that's a major part of his plan to kind of control the voting situation come 2026, you know, is to have National Guard in blue cities to deter people from hitting the polling booths, which he is making lots of changes. This is another 2025 thing. Looking back, he's making lots of changes to voting laws, attempting to make it so that people have to vote in person, get rid of the mail-in ballot, all in an attempt to maintain power come midterms next year.
And I might add just one other reason that comes to mind. I think a lot of it comes from a sense of powerlessness. Like, I can pretty rationally say, like, okay, if a judge can declare that Trump can't do something and he will still do it, then like me going and peacefully protesting, what impact will that have on Trump?
Yeah, none.
Or on anybody's willingness to step in and stop him, you know, and even if I were to take more extreme measures and not peacefully protest, but instead go do something violent, right? Like, hey, what impact would that even have? And it's similar to like climate change, right? Where it's like, okay, well, I do that. What difference is that going to make?
I recycled my plastic bottles. I reduced the amount of plastic bags I got from grocery stores.
It's just like the scope of what I can do to actually have an impact on the outcome is so minuscule that, okay, is it really worth putting energy into and perhaps putting yourself at risk?
Yeah. And we've seen it work in other countries and other places and other times. And we've seen it work in this country, you know, throughout history. But I do think that it requires, A, the people to be desperate enough to not have much to lose or to risk. And B, it takes leaders who are willing to listen. In large part, protesting in the past in the U.S. has worked because it puts pressure on Congress or on local leaders. If, you know, your local congressman knows that he can get voted out of office because he didn't listen to his constituents, who are all pissed off, and there's, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of them out on the streets, then he's going to, like, act to help his constituents vote that way and, you know, ensure his own reelection. Now that Trump's doing things without congressional approval and not really caring what anyone else thinks, then, yeah, is there as much purpose behind a protest or emailing your congressman or whatever? And I don't know. Again, I think this was a year that we're finding that out. And next year at the midterms will be a really interesting time to see, are these people who didn't vote the way that people wanted getting primaried? Are people getting out and voting? Or is that vote suppressed? Is there apathy? So many questions.
I wonder what kind of incident or event would have to occur to incite enough people, like, to get critical mass to actually have an impact. You know, if the government's pulling fingernails out of teenage kids, you know, we've seen examples of this in other parts of the world where something happens and that gets enough people upset that then you can reach that critical mass and go affect a change.
Well, so often, I think, just like with everything else, it has to affect the individual. You know, I think of, like, Arab Spring and how that came about because food prices skyrocketed and people couldn't afford food anymore. Like, it feels like to get mass movement in 2026, it would have to come from it hitting people in their pocketbooks.
The desperation.
Yeah, again, creating the desperation. That said, there are other ways to protest that could be more effective. People talk often about general strikes. You know, you talk about how it feels like nothing I can do will have an impact when it comes to protesting, going out and standing on the street corner with a flag or a sign. But a large group of people refusing to engage in the economy, refusing to, whether it is go to work for a short time, to make purchases from large corporations, to just engage in the system overall, has been proven to work. It takes less people, you know, than mass protests or riots. But it is one of those that, again, requires a lot of A, coordination, and B, there is risk and sacrifice involved. Going out and, you know, protesting on a street corner doesn't require a ton of sacrifice. It's an afternoon. And these protests that we see in the No Kings protests, they're on Saturdays when no one's working. You know, they don't require much. A general strike is asking a lot. It's asking you to forego wages. It's asking you to sacrifice purchases you might normally make or whatever luxuries you might normally have during that time, et cetera, et cetera. And it puts at risk perhaps your employment. So while something like that could be effective, we have not seen any mobilization or organization of people to actually do that.
Hey, this really takes me back to all the times we would dive down a rabbit hole.
I know. All right. That was a very small piece of internal stuff going on in the U.S. Let's jump to your next one. And then I still have like four categories left. I was going to lump in global politics and conflict. And then I had a couple others after that. But that took forever. Sorry, I talked so much. We'll just have to do probably a third episode or just skip talking about that stuff.
All right. Well, I'll dive into this. I just want to touch on a few things regarding the economy. So if you're listening and you live in the U.S., you probably have experienced some challenges this year when it comes to your pocketbook. But that's not the case for everybody. In 2025, the 10 richest U.S. billionaires collectively saw their wealth increase by roughly $698 billion.
Is that it? Kind of a rough year.
That's record gains for the very rich.
Which, by the way, all of those gains just so happen to equal about what Elon Musk is now worth. I read somewhere today it was like $660 billion. Are we going to have our first trillionaire by the next couple of years?
And just the amount of power that gives somebody when they have that degree of wealth is mind-boggling. Like the impact, like the influence that he is able to have on politics, on policy, on social sentiment, on a whole number of things. It's like no one person should hold that much power.
It's insane.
Federal Reserve data shows that the top 1% of households held about 31% of total U.S. wealth in mid-2025.
Wow.
1% holding 31% of U.S. wealth. And while all of that was going on, I'm jumping between a few articles here, but the U.S. economy added 64,000 jobs in November, but had lost 105,000 in October.
And this is as far as we can trust the data, which is not much these days.
Yeah, that you know, when you think about 162,000 federal jobs were cut as linked to, you know, policies under Trump. And oh, Elon.
Yeah. Our boy.
These two individuals sure have a lot of power.
Like, how did we just talked about politics for like 20 minutes and didn't even touch on like Doge or like all the cuts that were made? There just wasn't even room for that, which is absolutely wild. An administration cutting USAID and funding to that would be like the defining legacy of any president ever, you know? And it's like, I forgot to even talk about that in the little blip that we just did.
Manufacturing has lost jobs for 7 straight months. And the unemployment rate is at 4.6%, which is the highest since 2021.
Which was like right after COVID when it shot through the roof.
Yeah, and so we've seen the Fed trying to cut rates. It's a weird world where they're trying to deal with inflation, which continues, and also deal with the job market. So yeah, speaking of that, inflation, you know, they set their target at 2%, but CPI was 3%. Core services inflation was 3.8%. So like inflation is easing, but not in the way that they anticipated. And now with all these, you know, the unemployment rate going up, there's some really difficult decisions that have to be made and how they try to mitigate that.
Totally. And tariffs kicking in so many places and those effects coming down the line, it's really hard to know what is that going to look like. Does inflation reverse and go back up again?
Yeah. So just quickly to hit a couple of other highlights in regards to jobs. Between October and November alone, 134,000 tech positions were lost.
That is wild. 130,000. Did they give any information as to why those layoffs, or I guess why those jobs were lost?
To add to that, you know, direct statement here from the article, job postings dropped by over 31,800. Unemployment in tech hit 4%. They claim it comes from broad uncertainty, and a lot of these tech firms are investing heavily in AI infrastructure.
You and I talked a few years ago as ChatGPT came out. We talked about jobs and what was going to happen and our jobs going to start getting lost. And I feel like there was a little moment where everyone was like, no, jobs won't be lost. And any jobs that are lost, more will be created. And I feel like this year it started happening. We started seeing layoffs and lots of companies saying we're laying people off to replace them with AI. I experienced that personally with clients at work, them telling me that type of thing. And I know that this 130,000 that you're talking about here isn't all from AI. You just gave several different reasons. And much of it is just worries about the economy. But knowing that the direction that AI is headed is starting to have an effect is scary as well.
Yeah, there's just so much uncertainty. There was one article from the Wall Street Journal that they were looking at college educated workers. It was a look at like white collar profession. And there's just this perceived insecurity. And it mirrors the real insecurity that's there. But you look at like traditionally stable jobs like federal employment. Tech historically has been like a very safe place to put your career. Here's a statement from the article. White collar professionals now estimate a 15% chance of job loss within a year.
15% chance that any one person will lose their job, basically?
Yeah. And this is white collar professionals who are saying, I have a 15% chance of losing my job.
Okay. Their view is like their own personal opinion is that there's a 15% chance I'll lose my job. Yeah. Okay.
Just anecdotally, it's really interesting. I am the youngest of 5 in my family. I've talked with every one of my siblings who all have white collar jobs, and I have a white collar job. Like, I think we all feel fortunate. We're all college educated, but every single one of my siblings has said like work has been miserable lately. Like, it's just, I am being burdened with like more that's expected of me than ever before. There's more restrictions. There's more micromanaging. There are layoffs happening around me. I don't know how secure my job is, but I don't feel like I could go find a better job anywhere else. And like every single one of them individually has expressed that same thing, that like work compared to what it was even just a few years ago really sucks. All right. And then as you look forward, they look at some indicators to try to estimate what kind of GDP growth we will see. They look at things like just consumer expectations. They look at new orders. They look at a variety of different factors to try to make some predictions. And they are projecting that 2026 GDP will slow from what it had been in 2025. So the outlook isn't very optimistic. If you'll remember, there was a pretty intense stock market crash this year. And a lot of that had to do with the US, you know, the tariff announcements. There was panic selling. It was the largest global market decline since 2020. Things have kind of rebounded or stabilized to some degree, but there's just so much uncertainty, so much volatility. And then you add what you mentioned before, which was a 43-day government shutdown. Just the Congressional Budget Office estimated from that shutdown a permanent loss of about $11 billion to the U.S. economy.
Wow. I read somewhere, just while we're talking about numbers in the double digits of billions, Trump just announced that for farmers, he was doing this $12 billion bailout. And he's basically saying, like, we're able to take from the tariffs, which are bringing in so much money, and give back to the people. The tariffs have caused $44 billion in economic loss from farmers. So he is less than one third giving back to them in direct subsidy payments. But the loss is just staggering. How long can America's farmers go losing $50 billion a year before they have to find something else to do besides farm? And how long does Trump continue to say tariffs are the answer until, like, he figures it out that they're not?
You're talking about the impact of farmers. We mentioned that manufacturing jobs have been going negative for the last 7 months straight. White collar jobs are at major risk. It's hard to say, like, where are you actually safe? The most interesting conversation I had with somebody about their employment lately was I talked to somebody who does tile, and he was like, I've got more work now than I've ever had. Like, even in the pandemic, there was, you know, I had more work then than I had ever had before, but he's like, I'm even busier now. And you and I predicted that the AI in particular would have the biggest impact on white collar first, but then as it gets more introduced into robotics, it will have an impact on blue collar work more and more. And that's just the impact of AI, let alone the tariffs and the policy and the uncertainty and the global conditions and the conflict and everything else. So if you're scared about the future from an economic standpoint, you've got good reason to be.
That's comforting. Yeah, the economy is one of those things. Man, I started my job in 2018 that I work in now. And I remember when I started that job, everyone was talking about how the economy was about to fail, right? And it was like, I felt that and I was nervous about it. And it's been surprisingly resilient, at least on the surface, since then. And year after year, everyone talks about how it's about to fail, right? And I've gotten to this point now, 8 years later, where I'm like, I don't know what to think. Either the economy is more resilient than we give it credit for, or we're just so much better at hiding it, or we have just been barely staying afloat and we are on the edge of, you know, some economic catastrophe. And maybe 2026 is the year that we see that. Maybe we just see a continuation of like worsening conditions. Maybe it continues to stay afloat and, you know, there's some sort of mechanism that they pull on the back end to just keep us there. I don't know. I can't even hazard a guess anymore.
Yeah, I don't know how to predict it either. And apparently economists don't.
Totally.
Like, nobody knows.
Nobody.
But your comment about hiding it was really interesting, right? Because if we've seen all this growth in like the stock market, but that's only because of like a few corporations. And on an individual basis, if it's like, well, wealth has grown in the US, but then you see like, oh, it's the top 1% that's had this huge increase in their wealth. On the aggregate, things can look just fine. But it's when you look at like subsections of that, you're like, oh,
wait a minute.
Yeah. And we haven't even talked about like housing affordability, which this year, it's just been so brutal. But yeah, I'm sure we'll make some guesses when we talk about 2026. But let's be honest, we have no idea.
Nope, not a clue. Let's end this one here. And the other stuff that I had, I will do at a separate time. I think talked about the stuff that you prepared, so I can record a separate episode next week. For now, we'll end this one. We'll come back and we'll do one more. You're so lucky you get Kellen for a third day, and we'll discuss our thoughts, kind of what we're looking at in 2026. See you then.
Neulich bei der Versicherung.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof, Bahnhof.
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 Sie verstehen bei Ihrem Berater nur Bahnhof? Zeit zu Ergo zu wechseln, denn da verstehen Sie nur.
Einfach.
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 Denn wir machen Versichern einfacher. Einfach, weil's wichtig ist. Ergo.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.